As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses. As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men, for they are women's children, and we mother them again. Our lives shall not be sweated from birth until life closes.
We chose to begin our program with Bread and Roses because it was a theme from one of the early women's work movements. In 1912, women who worked in the textile mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts, struck against the conditions under which they worked and lived. The theme was described as follows, quote, "What the woman who works wants is the right to live, not simply exist. The right to life as the rich woman has the right to life and sun and music and art. You have nothing that the humblest worker has not the right to also have. The worker must have bread, but she must have roses too." Unquote. International Women's Day, which was declared in 1910 by Clara Zetkin to honor the March 8th demonstration for women's rights a few years earlier, has special significance today because the working lives and material conditions of women all over the world are more intimately and directly linked than at any other time in history. The members of the Women and Corporate Imperialism Project of the American Friends Service Committee in Portland recognize the development of transnational corporations as a vehicle through which this link is made. Our project, which grew out of the understanding that economic exploitation is a root cause of racism and sexism, both within the U.S. and in a global context, sees the growth of transnational economics as the most advanced stage of competitive corporate business, and which represents a new dimension in the struggles of women as workers and as victims of multiple oppressions. Our purpose is to actively support women's struggles as they develop and are organized, and to clarify the nature of our relationships as women to each other through the kinds of work we do and the conditions of our lives. By necessity, our work must consider women not only in the United States, but also throughout the world, particularly the less industrially developed countries of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Transnationals bring us together through common work experience, given that we have the same employers, and through consumption, as those products that one woman produces, another woman somewhere else purchases. Transnational corporations, by definition, are operational across national boundaries, moving investment dollars, technology, resources, and labor wherever in the world they are most efficient and therefore most profitable. Likewise, they distribute their product in as many markets as possible. It is important to understand that it is their transnational nature that is unique. The process of seeking out lower wages, increasing worker productivity, and getting the highest return is merely good business practice and an inherent necessity of all competitive business. Transnationals are merely the logical culmination of successful corporate development. As a focus, we have chosen the textile industry for several reasons. The production of cloth and clothing has been a part of women's labor historically. It was the first area of production to be industrialized, and it was women who were employed in the unhealthy and dangerous labor of the textile factories. Today, almost 2 million women are employed in the textile and apparel industries in the U.S. However, these numbers are declining as production has moved to lower wage countries where more women are employed and under more harmful conditions. According to the Executive Vice President of the American Textile Manufacturers Institute, quote, "Of all major manufacturing industries, textiles is perhaps the most truly international. Its raw materials and products move extensively in volume throughout the world. In this era of raising expectations in the underdeveloped nations, textiles play a dual role. Their production is one of the first operations undertaken in the course of industrialization, and their increased consumption is one of the earliest signs of rising living standards," unquote. One of the important questions of our study is rising living standards for whom? Textiles and apparel manufacture is also a local trade in Portland. White Stag is but one of the many subsidiaries and brand names of the transnational Warnaco. Aside from Warnaco of Canada and plants throughout the U.S., Mexico, Puerto Rico, Costa Rica, and the Dominican Republic, Warnaco has divisions in Northern Europe and licensees in 40 countries, including Taiwan, Japan, and Hong Kong. Janssen, a locally based corporation, in fact produces its products in over 20 different countries and distributes apparel to 100 countries all over the world. Production plants are located in Puerto Rico, Mexico, South Africa, Chile, the Philippines, Europe, Greece, and Japan, to name but a few. Almost half of all Janssen facilities in the U.S. are located in the South, North and South Carolina, and Louisiana. In the early history of textiles in the United States, mills were moved south from New England to low-wage and non-unionized regions of the Southeast. The shift was the first example of the runaway shop. The women workers of the North were left jobless and suddenly impoverished. Longer hours, lower pay, and the unhealthy conditions which could be imposed on the new workers because they were without the protection and unity of organized labor. One of the most blatant examples of corporate abuse, illegal health and safety practices, extremely low wages, and refusal to allow union organization is the J.P. Stevens Company. J.P. Stevens began as a small family-owned textile manufacturer in Massachusetts in 1813. Following World War II, it merged 10 companies and became the second largest corporate giant in the textile industry. In the last 30 years, it has acquired dozens of smaller firms and liquidated all its unionized plants in the North. It is a multinational corporation operating in 7 foreign countries and the U.S. J.P. Stevens employs more than 44,000 people, most of whom are women and none of which are covered by a union contract. For 15 years, the Stevens employees have been trying to organize themselves. In one town, the court ruled that the company must recognize the union, so Stevens just closed the plant. Violations of health and safety regulations include dust levels at 3 times the OSHA standards and noise levels often more than 20 times the legal minimum. Brown lung, a respiratory disease caused by cotton dust, its victims receive no compensation. One woman who had been an employee for 26 years had to have a radical mastectomy, a And when she asked to be transferred to an easier job, they told her she could either run the shop no matter what it did to her, she could quit, or she would be fired. Wages in the industry are the lowest in production. J.P. Stevens pays 31% less than the average national manufacturing wage. Stevens is able to get away with these practices because its multinational structure allows it to transfer production to other areas. Its financial resources give it strength to wage political battles to defeat workers' efforts, and much of its political base includes major ownership of many of the towns in which it operates, such as housing, stores, schools, and even utilities. In their struggle against Stevens, the employees have called for an international boycott of all Stevens products. In other instances where organizing has been effective, whole factories and businesses are moved to countries like South Korea, Mexico, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and South Africa, where wages are much lower, health and safety regulations are almost non-existent, unions are illegal or strictly controlled, and tax advantages for the corporations often mean no taxes on profits at all. The effects of this kind of business behavior has produced what is called the service economy in the United States. This will become more clear when we talk about the work that women have been doing in this country since World War II.
I work hard for my children, but they're my love, not my life. I've always been told it was our lot to endure, but I know it's not right. I deserve something more. Got a job in a factory and it's rough in this world. My kids are in high school, boss calls me girl, but the woman beside me as we sweat out the line says tomorrow is payday and the next day is mine. Oh, it's a race for the strong, cause it'll grind up the meat when your money runs short at the end of the week. Oh, this system buys hands, but you must not use your head. It'll shake you and break you till all your senses are dead. I've always been told it was our lot to endure, but I know it's not right. We deserve something more. Oh, I know there are answers, got to get to the source. Think me and this system better get a divorce. I can't make enough money, I can't find enough time, but I'm a working class woman and the future is mine. Oh, there's more where I come from, we've got anger to burn, but we're talking and moving, gonna study and learn. Build a unity train on a straight arrow line. If today is the boss's, I know tomorrow is mine. Oh, I wanted a partner to be his friend, not just wife. I work hard for my children, but they're my love, not my life. And I know it takes loving, and I know it takes time, but I'm a working class woman, and the future is mine. I'm a working class woman, and the future is mine.
Since the beginning of industrialization, women have been considered non-workers. Even though we have always participated in paid labor outside the home, our work has been considered marginal and temporary. Marginal because we are presumed to do less necessary work, not primary to the economy. And temporary because it is expected that we will go back into the home after marriage and not return for the duration of our children's lives at home. Of course, this perspective totally denies the necessity and value of the labor that is performed within the home. The unpaid food and clothing production, health and emotional care that women are expected to and do provide, without which there would be no working population at all. In other words, women not only work, we have a double work day. Since the end of the war, the number of women working outside the home has doubled. We now account for almost half the recognized workforce, and the greatest growth has been in the last 15 years. One measure of the increasing pressure for women to look for wage work is by the fact that those with preschool age children are the fastest growing segment of the working population. These women are the least likely to work outside the home at all. Almost half of all working women are mothers with children under 18, and many of them are single heads of households and are the sole or major means of financial survival. Yet the average wage for women workers is 40% lower than the average wage for male workers, and over the past 10 years, the earnings gap has widened. It is clear that the work we do is not temporary, and women work outside the home because they must. The interesting question about women's paid work is the question of marginality. Where do we fit in the economy? The first thing to keep in mind is that women do different work than men. We are restricted by custom, attitude, education, and law, generally to different fields, different kinds of jobs, and different results. Women are discriminated against as physically, emotionally, and mentally inferior, and are exploited as docile, unskilled, and manually dexterous workers. This is more clearly understood by looking at the kinds of jobs women have in the United States. The first thing to note is that women are employed in jobs that are of the same supportive and nurturing role that they fulfill as wives and mothers. A very sizable number of women are employed as maids, beauticians, waitresses, stewardesses, and institutional workers such as nursing home, hospital, and school attendants. Service work is the second largest occupational category for women. Another large employer is manufacturing. 12% of all women in paid jobs are factory operatives. However, the kinds of productive work they do is food processing and canning, pharmaceutical preparation, electronic parts assembly, and textile and apparel manufacture. More than half of all cashiering and counter work in food, drug, clothing, general merchandising, and department stores is done by women. These retail jobs are the lowest paying sales jobs available. There are women in the professions, however, their professional status is for the most part restricted to nursing and teaching primarily in the elementary grades. The largest category of all women employed outside the home, a full 35%, is the most recently developed and fastest growing occupation of all, the secretarial and clerical field. With the maturing of our economy and the growth of banks, insurance companies, and corporate headquarters, the dependence of capital on secretaries, bookkeepers, filing clerks, typists, and computer operators has forced business to develop such familiar factory models as continuous flow processes and routinized work structures. The office as a place of mass employment has become, to quote a famous observer of the function of labor, just as much a site of manual labor as the factory floor. We mentioned that 12% of the women who had paid jobs in the U.S. were factory operatives. Before World War II, there were twice as many women in productive labor jobs. Where have these jobs gone? Business explains that factories are built offshore, which simply means in another country, usually overseas. South Korea is one of those places. In the past 10 years, over 76 U.S. firms have established production relationships with the export-oriented industries of South Korea. This means that the industrialization process, so often described as South Korea's economic miracle, is in reality the building of factories and assembly plants with the help of U.S. capital and other industrially developed nations for the purposes of production for export back to the U.S. or the rest of the developed world. The primary industries involved are the electronics, pharmaceutical, and apparel industries. and the workers they hire are almost exclusively women. The conditions under which these products are manufactured would be illegal in this country, and in fact parallel the working climate in the U.S. in the 1800s and early 1900s. Young women, often as young as 11 years, are hired from the poor peasant families of the countryside or the swelling urban population suffering massive unemployment. The unmarried are housed in dormitories built near the factory sites where their lives are controlled by the company overseers. They work 14 to 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. At peak periods, they may work round the clock. They are given pep pills to see them through the night shifts and are allowed no toilet breaks. Fines are extracted if they arrive late or leave early. Mass hysteria from the tension of the job often breaks out and individual women are fired or severely reprimanded as a result. Yet these same women who produce all these products are not financially able to purchase them. And the fact that they are for export means that they are not available to them anyway. The average wage for one of these women workers is 7,000 to 8,000 won per year. According to government standards, the minimum necessary for subsistence is 85,000 won. In American currency, their wages average less than 25 cents an hour.
A man in the back row stood up and he said, women are the frail sex, we're always busy helping them. In and out of carriages, up and over ditches.
Corporations have a production advantage over more nationally owned and based businesses because they can produce their goods wherever cheap labor can be found, and they can distribute their products throughout the world as well. All this at prices far exceeding the cost of producing them. The effort to market all these goods has created a multi-billion dollar advertising business, mainly from New York, that carries names like Coca-Cola, Ford, Kodiak, and Nestle across the globe, often to regions impoverished by the development of these same global corporations. U.S. agribusiness that owns whole sections of the most productive farmland, which produce cash crops like bananas, coffee, sugar, and cocoa for export to the industrially developed world, leaves countries like Puerto Rico, Korea, and the Dominican Republic, and some South American countries dependent on imported food and with high unemployment. Modern technology brought in by industrial firms in forms like assembly plants and food processors use far fewer people than are looking for work. More women than men are employed, for their so-called docility, dexterity, and low skill level. Also, as carriers of culture and values, television, radio, and advertising campaigns encourage and give hope of a better life through industrialization and consumption. After World War II and the economic boom that followed, production in America distributed consumer goods in previously unimaginable quantities. Electrical appliances, TVs, fashionable clothing, home furnishings, and household products of all kinds flooded the market and projected an outlook of unlimited prosperity. Each year there were new developments and styles were outdated in a matter of months. Credit was issued and the time payments expanded the money supply to allow for all of the purchases. Fast food, store-bought clothing, paid entertainment, and increased mobility decreased the productive value of the home and changed the family into a unit mainly for consumption. Women, by the nature of their domestic roles, have been the major consumers in society. We are expected to make the purchases that keep our families well cared for and happy. We are expected to take responsibility for the home and its physical condition and appearance. And of course, we make purchases for ourselves. Sexist ideology, well used by advertising, encourages constant wardrobe changes, jewelry and makeup fashion, hair cleansers and conditioners, and any number of assorted body lotions, scents, and creams. The message from promotion is that freedom and better living can be found through increased consumption. In the countries of rapid industrialization, new techniques are developed to bring the promises of consumer life to the workers. In assembly plants in Malaysia, for example, beauty contests and beauty classes teach the women how to look and act American. Western clothing styles, hair fashions, and makeup become the sought-after images of young and adventurous women. Some even bleach their hair or have plastic surgery to imitate the American ideal. Things like pop music, TV, movies, Coca-Cola all bring messages of the modern good life. Cultural values of traditional societies are invaded and erupted by advertising campaigns designed and produced by people in New York City. The most controversial element of this sudden expansion of the job market is that these women are given a measure of independence that they have never known before, and one for which they are willing to sacrifice a great deal. For long hours of work under intense pressures and workloads, a measure of freedom allowed by a few cents for a new product and the hope of a new life is often stronger than the rapidly deteriorating social fabric of their native land. Women in these and other third world countries are the providers of their homes and families also. As a result, advertising campaigns and new products find their ways into the lives of women who are not working as well. A specific example of this is the severe abuse of native women by the Nestle Corporation. Nestle is a transnational, selling its food products all over the world. Baby formula, once a popular product in the United States, lost its appeal some time ago. With diminishing markets at home, Nestle took its canned milk substitute into the malnutritioned areas of the Southern Hemisphere and convinced these impoverished mothers that breastfeeding was unscientific, outdated, and unhealthful. Women lured by the salaries of Nestle wear uniforms and appear as mothercraft nurses throughout the villages advising new mothers to use the baby formula. Posters of healthy, chubby babies implied that baby formula would reduce the infant mortality rate and produce healthier children. The consequences of this widespread marketing have been successful for Nestle, but have increased malnutrition and lowered the age at which children suffer from lack of adequate diet, raised the rates of permanent brain damage, and increased infant deaths. Baby formula is not necessary for a mother who is physically able to nurse. These artificial products do not contain the necessary and valuable agents produced naturally in mother's milk. And the conditions under which most of these women live are not conducive to the necessary preparation and maintenance of prepared formula. They do not have the clean water, the refrigeration, sterilization facilities, or money to use the formula according to directions. Many mothers cannot afford the $5 per can, which under proper preparation would last only a few days. So they water it down to last, say, 3 weeks. This is only part of the story, but as you can see, there are multiple and severe repercussions. So the question comes to what can we do? The most important thing we can do is to inform ourselves about the conditions we have discussed. Be conscious and aware of the ways in which corporate advertising, business interests, and oppressive values narrow and limit our lives, divide people from each other, and encourage us to consume ever-increasing quantities of high-priced, low-value goods at the expense of other people and the environment. It is equally important to join with people in efforts to struggle against these conditions. Two immediate ways we can join and show our support for women's struggles is through the boycott of J.P. Stevens products and all Nestle's products. Both of these products are international. Both of these boycotts are international, which not only gives us the strength to succeed, but also gives us hope in working with our sisters and brothers everywhere to affect change in our lives.
Well, they got women on TV, but
I still ain't satisfied.
'Cause co-optation's all I see, and
I still ain't satisfied.
They call me miss, they sell me blue jeans. Call it women's lip, they make it sound obscene. And I still ain't,
whoa, they lied.
I still ain't,
whoa, they lied.
And I still ain't,
whoa, they lied.
And I still ain't satisfied. Well, they got women prison guards,
but I still ain't satisfied.
With so many still behind bars, and
I still ain't satisfied.
I don't plead guilt, I don't want no bum deal. I don't want crumbs, I want the whole meal. And I still ain't,
whoa, they lied. Whoa, they lied.
I'm telling the truth,
whoa, they lied.
And I still ain't satisfied. They liberalized abortion,
I still ain't satisfied.
'Cause it still costs a fortune,
and I still ain't satisfied.
I'm singing about control of my
own womb,
and no reform, no reform is gonna change my tune. And I still ain't,
whoa, they lie.
Won't
stop
now. I'm gonna keep pulling on, and I still ain't satisfied. They give out pennies here and there, but
I still ain't satisfied.
To set up centers for child care,
I still ain't satisfied.
And while we work every day at slave wages to brainwash our kids at tender ages, and I still ain't,
whoa, they lied.
And I still ain't,
whoa, they lied.
And I still ain't,
whoa, they lied.
And I still ain't satisfied. I've got some pride, I won't be lied to. I did decide that halfway won't do. And I still ain't,
whoa, they lied.
I still ain't,
whoa, they lied.
And I still ain't,
whoa, they lied.
And I still ain't
satisfied. Whoa, they lied.
And I still ain't
satisfied.